Hey, this is Eddie Spaghetti from the greatest rock and roll band in the world, the Supersuckers.
Hey, this is Joe from the Mises.
This is Adam Franklin from Slow Driver.
This is Artie Lang from the Howard Stern Show.
Hey, this is John from the Fed.
Hey, this is Rick Kubik, drummer from Natarose.
This is Josh Hayden from Spain.
Matt Sharp from The Rentals, and you are listening to...
And you're listening to the Dark Stuff Podcast.
And you're listening to the Dark Stuff Podcast.
The Dark Stuff Podcast.
Thackeray from Pacific Street Blues. Of course, Thackeray, coming out of Virginia, now living down in Arkansas, was a member of the Nighthawks forever and a day.
Hey, everybody. It's me, Dave Splash, from thedarkstuff.com and the Dark Stuff Podcast. I have returned with podcast number 118. In this episode, I interview Rick Galusha. Now, Rick spent the better part of maybe 2.5 decades working inside of the record business. He worked for the record chain in Omaha, and it's actually Nebraska and Iowa, called Homer's Records. And like I said, he was in for about 25 years. We're going to talk, as a lot of my podcasts venture into this area of discussing the decline of the music business and sort of the state of affairs in the music business today. It's also a really great look back to the history of the record store, how it used to be such a really, really important part of the fabric of people's lives. And it's a personal story for Rick. It's a personal story for me. Rick also hosts a radio show here in town. He's on the same station I am, actually. We both do a show on 89.7 The River. KIWR is the call letters for those of you outside of the Omaha metro area. He hosts a show called Pacific Street Blues and Americana. He's been on the air about 25 years at this point. I'm inching up on 10, so I'm still like the newbie by comparison. So this interview, we talk a lot about the Homer's record store. There's a lot about the history of Omaha in here too. I think it's a really, really great interview, and I'm just going to give it to you virtually uncut. Hope you enjoy this one. This is podcast number 118 with Rick Galusha. When did you actually just become interested in music? When did you start picking up records and that kind of stuff?
When I was a kid, I had a bone disease. And so my mom, there were three of us. So my mom, you know, I was the youngest, would put me on the front porch. I was in traction, full traction. For over a year, I was in a full body cast. And she would allow me to play records, which I can still sing, because you can imagine there were probably 10 records. And when you're in traction, that's all you can do. And so since my earliest memories, I played records. What kind of turned me into a rock music fan was my sister bought me the Hot Rocks, Rolling Stones. And then at the same Christmas gave me the original Boss Gag solo record, which featured Duane Allman on it. And so that kind of, I think, took me off in the direction that I've always kind of clung. You know, I've been a Stones fan ever since. So that would have been like 70, 71. Okay. And the first record I remember buying, there were two. It was DOA by Blood Rock, which is a terrible song. And Temptation Eyes by the Grassroots.
That's a good song.
Yeah, that's a real good song.
Replacements actually covered that, by the way.
Did they really?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And so, you know, those are the first 45s I bought. And, you know, we grew up, we were living at 25th and Kansas Avenue, so in North Omaha. And so all the kids around us were listening to Motown. And so there's a little bit of the Osmonds, but that never, you know, it was really the Jackson 5. And I can remember, you know, the kids on the neighborhood would just start bust out a record and start dancing, you know. And it's not, I don't think white kids would do that, but they were doing it. And so, you know, I kind of grew up around that. And I can remember in the fourth grade, we were allowed to bring records. And then over lunch hour, we would play records. And that was in the fourth grade. In the third grade, Miss Scott would play a Christian hymns on the foot pump organ, which of course was outlawed then. So it shifted from Christian hymns and Christmas carols on a foot pump organ to records. And so every kid would have a stack of 45s in their desk, pop-up.
Wow.
So, you know, I can't ever really not remember, but, you know, it's kind of funny. I remember the earliest albums Dad would bring home, like those Firestone Tire Christmas records. So it was,
I don't know if I've ever seen those.
And, you know, it would have like Julie Andrews and that stuff on there. And you know, the great, what I would describe as kind of the great male-female vocals, Great American Songbook. But these came out at the Christmas time, and it was Firestone Records. And so I remember those maybe two years. Like, I can vividly remember the, one of the covers. And so that had to be 65, 66.
Wow.
So, I mean, it goes back. My sister, who's old, well, my brother and sister are both older, but my sister is 6 years older. And so she was always buying records. So that heavily influenced me. And I can remember the second Led Zeppelin album coming home, and it had a gold record on it. And I can remember vividly asking her, you know, what is a gold record? And she says, well, this is a record like everybody, like Hollywood stars buy them. I'm like, oh, it must be good then, yeah. You know?
Well, that sounds really good.
So I remember that really vividly.
Now, are you a musician? Do you play music yourself?
I can. I would never, you know, to me, the term musician is a great honor, you know? And so I can play. I think I'm, on a 1 to 10 scale, I think I'm probably a 6.5 or 7, you know? So relatively fluid. I can pick a song out. But, you know, when you look at gifted musicians, and what comes to my mind right now is this young kid in Omaha, like Mitch Getman, which,
yeah,
I don't know if you...
He's playing a show at the new, at Reverb coming up, okay, in a couple of weeks, I think.
And you know, when you hear guys like that where, or, you know, Peter Gabriel or Nick Drake, those guys to me are so far superior in terms of maybe songwriting, but they're hearing notes and the combination of notes I can't hear. And yet, as you, when you listen to their records, it's marvelous. And so those guys are musicians. So
yeah.
I can play, I can read. I learned how to play trumpet, but, you know, I would never denigrate the term by claiming to be one.
Okay, so you referenced the Stones and some other... would you say that those are the records, the Rolling Stones maybe, that made you want to sort of get into the music business in general?
Yeah, I mean, So, as a kid, you know, I was... They were rock stars, you know, they were rock gods. And you know... it was, they idolized these guys. And so I think when I look at what kids are, the bands that kids are listening to today and the way that the bands and the acts are projected, I think they kind of miss that element. And on the one hand, I think it's probably really healthy because Lord knows in the 70s, the rock stars were not setting a good moral example of how we should behave. But,
because, well, that you mentioned there, the sort of the rock star thing, and you know, there was a big quote that came out a couple of weeks ago. Gene Simmons says rock is dead and all this.
Yeah.
And, of course, that's ridiculous. But I think the idea, really, he left off a word. The rock star is dead.
Yeah.
Because there really aren't any rock and roll stars. Big stars in music today are rap or pop, and there really aren't any rock stars. Axl Rose might have been the last real, or maybe Kurt Cobain.
Well, I think U2.
U2.
Those guys
they're
are
still,
rock stars.
Yeah, I guess they do still qualify, but because I feel like they came from another era almost because they've been around for so long.
They do, and it's something I think in our generation where we're prepared to bestow that title and the honor that goes with it on people, whereas I think the younger kids, and you see this in other patterns, millennials or whatever are, I think, much more cynical to the point perhaps of being unhealthy about it, and they're not willing to give up any sort of accolade or any, you know, acknowledgement, and I think that the kids kind of lose out on that, and there might be some good aspects to it, but then I kind of look at is it Death Cab for Cutie?
Yeah.
Which I don't really connect with those guys, but when I look at the way that people talk about them, they seem to get a lot of that you know, compliments, and people like them in a way different than they like a lot of other bands. It appears to me. You know, so.
Well, it's weird because do you think the decline of the rock star really has more to do with, you know, people growing up in a cynical way, like you say, or is it because of the decline of the traditional music business? Because they're sort of go hand in hand, but also there's also this counter thing of in the 90s and sort of maybe in the 80s too, in the underground scene, it was very much being anti-rock star.
Right.
And it was almost an embarrassment to be called a... Kurt Cobain was embarrassed that he was a rock star because of the poor examples that had come before him. You know, it was
right.
because of the hair metal scene and, you know, he didn't want to be identified with that. And that was a different era, you know. Mm-hmm. That was when people still bought records and you could, I guess, earn a living being like a decent selling artist. You didn't have to sell 10 million albums to make a living. You could do 500,000 and still probably do okay.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering that just popped into my head. Do you think it was more, it is a cultural thing, or is it a sort of a decline in the traditional music business?
When I look at rock music, which in my mind kind of begins around 1962 or 1963, there's really kind of, I think, three pivotal albums. And so in a long way around, I'm going to try to answer your question. And if I forget, remind me. But you know, I think for a lot of different reasons, Sgt. Pepper changed the path dependency of rock music, where the studio officially becomes a member of the band.
Yeah.
And some people will argue that was Pet Sounds, and okay, I'll go with that argument. I think the second record that really changed the direction of rock and roll was Nevermind the Bollocks by the Sex Pistols, where my generation kind of went through that anti-rock star phase where, you know, music went back into the garage, and it was a really healthy transition. And then I think that what we're talking about here is Nirvana, is It Smells Like Teen Spirit,
yeah,
kind of thing. I think that album changed the course of rock, and it has not, to my knowledge, been changed since then, where they tore down all the presidium around the stage. There was no distance between the performer and the audience. And again, you know, it's healthy, it's cool, it makes it the people's music kind of thing again, but you lose that illusion. And over the years, I became friends with a guy that's managed a lot of bands, Styx and REO and Robin Trower, Derek Sutton. And Derek made this great comment one time, which I always, you know, I think it was really astute, which he said, 95% of people listen to music with their eyes. And I think he's right in that regard, where it's show business.
Yeah.
And we want some show. And I think one of the things that, you know, again, when we go to the see independent bands or whatever, you know, it's kind of kids that dress like I do, and they're not very exciting to watch, and they're playing songs that are kind of mournful, and it's like, good Lord, you know, I want to escape,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
And so some of that seems lost, and I think that, in my mind, occurred when the Nirvana went over from, over to a major label, over onto Geffen.
Yeah.
And you know, it all kind of changed then. What was a niche then became a very wide brush statement and just kind of swept everything out of its way. And I don't know what the order was, but it seems to me that rap kind of simultaneously was there. And so these two new styles filled that void, and rock became kind of uncool.
And I think it also had something to do with when you tie in rap like that, is that rap stars were very big about boasting and
yeah.
about, hey, I'm the best, I'm the greatest, I'm this and that. That used to be the sort of the rock thing mm-hmm. of, you know, I'm the biggest, baddest, this, and I'm the greatest guitar player, and the, you know, I got the biggest dick, and, you know, I'm looking
yeah.
at my, in my tight jeans, you know, I'm the lead singer
yeah.
or whatever. And that, Kurt Cobain and everything kind of did erase that to mm-hmm. a very real degree and make that sort of embarrassing.
Yeah.
And people didn't want to be like that. But now, like, people do kind of long for it a little bit because it's hard to have a sustained career. It's hard to do these other things. It's sort of like, you know, you have a handful of bands that are still doing it, like,
yeah.
you know, Weezer, U2, the Foo Fighters, maybe something like that, that can still draw really big crowds. But
right.
a lot of it, if it's not, people, things get so, I also think it has to do with really the intense, like, genrefication of everything. Everything's a genre and a subgenre of that genre.
Mm-hmm.
And now that everyone gets their music from the internet, you can search for just that little genre or make playlists of just that, and you never are exposed to anything else. The loose term of rock is meaningless anymore because young kids, I don't like rock music. No, I like, you know, Scandinavian black metal. I like, you know, this kind of stuff.
Basement death metal, yeah.
Right, and, you know, just something really obscure or...
Mm-hmm.
you know, three genres down if you were doing like a pie chart, or not a pie chart, but whatever.
Branch were, tree, fishbone.
Whatever it is, yeah. You know what I'm saying? I don't know.
Well, I think, that, I mean, there's a lot of dynamics going on. And you know, we talked a moment ago about kind of the cynicism among millennials, which some would argue began really with Watergate in 73, 74. But you know, when we look at the music industry's reflection, I think, is society on a larger scale where, you know, we buffer everything. So why is this not live? It's buffered, you know, so people can listen to it when they want to consume it. Uh-huh. And that's the nature of how we are. And so, you know, along with the Nirvana and shortly thereafter that period, like you say, everything kind of splintered off into massive micro niches. And so if you think about like rock in its heyday, there were probably five genres of music and there would be 600 albums a year. Today, and I don't know what the most current numbers are, but the last time I looked, there's, you know, there's probably about 35,000 albums. And the one thing we need to, or CD releases or whatever, but the one thing we need to recognize is every CD is a double album. You know, and so if you think about rock at its heyday, you know, maybe from 1965 to 1978 or so, there are probably five double albums. You can count on one hand the number of great double albums that were recorded when rock and roll, rock music was at its height. And yet today, every artist is expected at least once a year to produce the equivalent of a double album.
Right.
And it's crap.
You can fit 75 minutes on a CD, might as well fill it up.
Well, and you get the writer's royalty and you get the performance royalties. I think it's 7.5 cents per track per both. So, you know, why wouldn't you do it? But if you talk to artists, and I know, you know, you do that through your show as well, is no one listens after the 10th track.
Yeah.
You know, so you could put anything on there. And what I love, and maybe you're seeing this too, is you'll get a CD and it has 14 tracks on it and two bonus tracks. I'm like, what the hell? It's a CD, you know?
Why is it even a bonus? Because this is the original release. So
yeah,
these are just the extra. These are the same tracks.
You know, it's not like when The Clash released the London Calling album and The Train in Vain, they didn't even label the song that came out originally. Well, it was on there, but it wasn't labeled.
It wasn't labeled. Yeah, it was on the back of the cover, the cover album.
And so you had to listen all the way through the record to come across the hit, which was pretty cool. I mean, that was a very cool band.
So that was intentional and not an accident?
You know, I don't know. I always felt it was intentional, but it could have been something where some record executive added it on without, you know, I don't know the sequence. I always figured it was an intentional because they were so concerned about their credibility.
Yeah.
You know, and that they seemed to, and you see other, like Neil Young is good at this. I think Springsteen's good at it, where they build their career to a height and then they do everything they can to tear it back down so it's manageable. Mark Knopfler from Dire Straits did that when he went solo, you know. And so I just figured that's the Clash's modus operandi. You know?
Well, let me take it back to you and to now to getting into the Homers thing. So,
sure.
Did you work in a record store as a teenager, or how did you first get involved with Homers?
Well, I always remember going to Homers. You know, my sister would take us down to the old market, and it was not the old market that we have today. Remember Satan's Pizza was on the corner and, you know, so Satan's Pizza. But, when I was 16, I had a job out at Westroads. I was working at the movie theater, Six West, and at Gizmos.
Six West and Gizmos. Wow. I haven't heard those terms in so long.
and so I didn't realize it at the time, but Homer's had, put a store in McCrory's, which was kind of a department store called Moby Disc. And so on my breaks at either job that summer, I would go down to Moby Disc and put out records. And I got to know the staff, which was the manager was a guy named Tom Kazmarek, and Elaine Braun was the assistant manager, and Colette and Mike Hottaby, who was Mike Cody on KQ98. So got to know them, just hung out. Eventually, Tom Kazmarek became the manager of the Homer store, which was at Bel Air, the second location, not the downtown store. And so he offered me a job, and eventually, and I started working, I think, on a Monday. And, you know, so I worked throughout college for Tom, and then Tom left, and Mike Fratt became the manager. And so worked for those two guys in the early, from 79 through 83.
Okay.
And then went to
Houston. That's when you first started with 79?
Yeah,
okay.
Working and getting paid. And it wasn't very much pay, you know.
Now, how long had Homer's, when did the first Homer's open?
1971. It was opened, if you remember the Spaghetti Works, was a live music venue. So I don't remember this, but as I understand, like Count Basie and that ilk would, you know, really credible jazz musicians would play there. But the building was owned by Gal's father and at that time. And so where the Zio's used to be,
okay,
is that right? There was a store there, and eventually that was the original location. And as I understand it, because obviously I wasn't there in 1971, is her dad owned the building. So they put the Homer store in there. It's like five guys, of which one was a Bruce Kleiman and a Bruce Hoberman, and then this gal, and I don't know who the other two people were. And eventually it kind of winnows down to Bruce Hoberman owns Homer's. And so he moves it, and it moved it over onto 11th Street, which is kind of in between what is now the hair place and the Omaha Prime. So the Omaha Prime was the, I believe, the site for the second Homer's location. And so when you went in, you would go in, and upstairs were the 8-tracks and cassettes. On the main floor were the records. And then if you went over to the corner, you could go downstairs, which is where they had smoking utensils and T-shirts.
Uh-huh.
And so that's the store I remember first.
And that's the one you worked at?
No, I worked at Bel Air, which was 122nd Center. And so there was always kind of this attitude of, you know, those crazy hippies in the old market store. And we're not crazy hippies. We were, you know, Stiff Records was huge in that period. So you know, we were kind of the punks, and they were kind of the stoners, was kind of the attitude. And you know, near the two shall meet. So
now, explain the trajectory of Homer's, because if it went from two stores, what was it at its peak? How many stores was it at its maximum?
At its peak, we had 17 locations.
Wow.
And so what had happened is Bruce started it in 71. And sometime, I think, around 93 or 94, he sold it to a guy that was running RTI, and Tom. And so...
Well, explain what RTI is for people that don't...
RTI was originally called Records and Tapes, Inc. Okay. And so Bruce had Homer's up and running, and it was doing real well, and the guy that owned a record distributor decided he wanted out. So he talked Bruce into buying Records and Tapes. And so... which then we always call it R&T. And so that was over there next to the Unitarian Church on Farnham. About 36th and Farnham.
I just remember when it was out at...
13533 I-Circle?
Yeah, I-Circle. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so as far as I know, it... well, actually, I believe the original location was on Leavenworth, and then Bruce moved it over onto Farnham, which is next door to, it's now the parking lot next to the Unitarian Church there, but there was a building there. And then it eventually moved then out to 135th and I Circle out in Millard. And so Homer's bought Records and Tapes and always owned RTI.
Okay.
And eventually they split the corporations off a little bit, and RTI kind of went into wholesale, not only music, but stereo equipment and TVs and electronics and stuff. And Homer's stayed music. And so eventually Bruce built it up to five locations, which was Bellevue. So I know the addresses if you need them. But so he had five locations. And then Tom bought it. And Tom was never really a music guy. He was a really good salesman. And he, for a lot of different reasons, became the owner. And so he went out and opened a new location in Council Bluffs, and then bought Twisters and Pickles. And so at one point in time, I think there were 17 stores altogether. So we would have stores in Lincoln within a block of each other. Yeah, and you know, we're buying signs and closing and consolidating. And it was a really, you know, a lot of people had their feelings hurt because, you know, which store stays, which store goes, who loses their job, who doesn't. And so we tried to go through that process without being, you know, malicious. But, you know, there were some hurt feelings there. And
when did Homer's buy Pickles out? Because I remember growing up with Pickles also existing.
Right.
Because that I very much remember on 84th Street.
Mm-hmm. On
84th
Dodge.
And Dodge.
Right by Arthur's?
Yeah. They had one there, and they had one out Oh, gosh, like 140-something in center, maybe, or somewhere out there?
There was one on a 153rd and T in Millard Plaza. And
maybe I'm thinking of that.
There was the one on Dodge. There were, like, there was one in Gretna. And then Lincoln was, like, 14th and R and 48th and Van Dorn. And so I miss... there was one out by, I think, Shadow Lake area in Lincoln. So that's, does that get me to six? I think it
does. Yeah, probably. I don't know. I wasn't counting.
So, yeah. And Nick Armijo ran the Omaha stores. He's a good guy.
Okay. So that was what, the late 80s, early 90s? When
I think it was the mid-90s when Tom bought the Pickles store. So he bought, I think he bought Pickles first and then Twisters. Am I remembering that right? God, I can't remember now. But
so at its peak, was it 17,
right.
18 stores? 17. 18 stores. Now, what kind of money was that operation taken in? Was that like just millions and millions of dollars? Or how well was the chain really doing at its peak in the 80s or maybe in the early 90s? Because I think what people have a hard time remembering, or people who weren't there, anyone under 30, maybe under 25 for sure, who never had that experience of you need to go to a place to get music.
Right.
You can't just sit at your computer or go to Best Buy or something like that. It was a record store. That's where
right.
we went to. I don't really remember how big a deal that was, and how even if you like gospel music or class, I mean, I worked at a record store in Wisconsin when I was in college. And the whole, it was a giant store, about the equivalent of like Homer's in the Old Market.
Is that the guy that had all the caps on his pens in Madison?
Well,
what was the name of the?
It was Exclusive Company.
Yeah.
And there was the guy, an older man named Charles, ran the classical store downstairs. The entire basement was a classical store, and they did amazing business.
Yeah.
And this guy had been in the record business. I used to talk to him because he was so interesting, but. He started in the 1940s.
Wow.
He used to have his own record store, but he wasn't very good at business and kind of just would spend and spend and spend. The store. So he ended up moving to the Exclusive Company. But he ran that classical thing for like 40 years.
Yeah.
And a really interesting guy.
Well, you know, the music store industry, I mean, if you look at the entire model of the music industry prior to Napster and the MP3, it's all set up as kind of a gatekeeper system. And so in one aspect, that's a great thing because it reduces, it makes it easier to find what you're looking for. So as radio began to niche out by format, people then began to develop, you know, I'm a country guy, I'm a pop music guy. And that was reflected in radio and they would come in. And so there was a restricted availability of titles. And then what happened as the CD came along, you know, I like to say the good thing about CDs is anybody could make a record. And the bad thing about CDs is anybody could make a record, you know. And so all of a sudden the titles exploded. And you could see where the cost per title for like a local artist would be instead of a 45 RPM, it would be a CD. And they could, you know, for a buck and a half or whatever, a disc, put CDs out. Now all of a sudden we had 200, 300 titles in the local music section. And people would come in and they were just like, you know, it's like when you walk, I don't know about you, but you walk into a wine store and you're like, okay, I want a Cabernet or whatever. And you go to the section, you don't know any of the labels. And so you begin to look at, well, what are the labels I know? I don't know any of these. So how do I pick? Here's one. You know, now people won't do that. Music is such an emotional experience. They don't do that with music. And so to some degree, I think that when the floodgates opened, it just created, people were befuddled.
I have a question for you, because I have a personal theory, and I want to see if it works with you.
Okay. Now,
do you think the decline of the record store, and coincides with the decline of the traditional music industry, really, do you think it started with Napster and downloading, or, my theory, when the record labels started to sort of overlook record stores and start directing co-op ad money towards Best Buy and Walmart and stuff like that, sort of ignoring their traditional outlets and really trying to drive people to other places like a Best Buy or whatever. I mean, that my theory is Napster and downloading was a big part of it.
Yeah.
But the industry started screwing itself earlier than that by kind of dicking over record stores to a certain degree. I mean, does that hold any water with you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's kind of like which is more painful, cutting off your left hand or your right hand? They both contributed to the decline. You know, the music industry always had kind of a maverick industry. If you look at the foundation of the music industry, you know, it's a lot of Jewish guys did quite well and really created kind of this entertainment industry. And if you look at those original labels, whether it's Roop down in New Orleans or the Chess Brothers up in Chicago, they began that process. And then as it blossomed kind of into pop culture a little bit more, you know, guys like me came into it, good thing or bad thing, depending, I'm sure some people have opinions. But eventually what happens simultaneously is it becomes big business in the 70s, huge business. I mean, the dollars are amazing. And so you look at the evolution of, you know, one of the great kind of ideas is when the Stones toured America in, whatever, 67 or 66, you know, it was all screaming teenagers. And then when they come back in 69, because of amplification, they could just blast, you know, the noise out, and for the first time they could hear themselves. And so that transition of technology is married up with the development of radio, and it becomes huge business. And then you hit the kind of the 80s where cocaine comes in and really kind of just wipes out, I think, creativity a lot, which created that opportunity where punk came in and then kind of quickly died out. But I guess what I'm saying is as the MBAs began to filter into the music industry, because there was so much available money there, and I'm sure you've read the story about Casablanca Records and stuff.
Oh, sure.
You know, that sort of arrogance and corruption and lack of clarity couples then. So the music industry, like, if you remember the soundtrack to the Titanic, what had happened is, so we're selling CDs for like $11.88, $12.88 or whatever, and this soundtrack for Titanic comes out and it's huge, and it's like a $17.98 list price, and so we're having to put it on sale for $14.88, $15.88, and there's one vocal track on it and the rest is all incidental music. Well, the fan is furious because they're spending an unreasonable amount of money for just one song, and that's indicative of the entire music industry, which is how do we, in essence, we have a monopoly or an oligopoly, really, and we have the ability to force people to do what we want. We can force the issue. We can push up prices. We can restrict quality. We can make stars out of people that have no business being in the music industry. And you know, I think the fan just gets fed up. And so, really, I think in a lot of ways, in addition to what you're talking about, which is the erosion of the traditional base where there was a lot of knowledge in the independent stores that you're not going to find in a Best Buy, but Best Buy pimped out the product and bought the traffic, basically, and you know, people saved a few bucks. Who could blame them? But when the MP3 comes out and you can get music for nothing, I think the listener is so furious at the industry that fuck you guys, I'm going over here because it's free, yeah, and I've paid enough, and now I want it the way I want it. One of the things I remembered about when I was still in the industry is there was a guy that ran Tower Records or Virgin Records named Glenn Ward. And I can remember sitting in a room in a conference room in New York City with all the muckety mucks from all the labels. So the guy that was Rush's manager and running Atlantic Records was there, and Sylvia Rhone from Elektra was there, and all these impressive names of the absolute pinnacle of all these labels. And Glenn is putting this argument out about, we need to go back to the single. You know, we need to put singles out again. And they're telling us it's $1 million for every SKU, stock keeping unit, and blah, 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 blah. And we can never do this. And if you look at the music industry today, it's a singles driven industry. And Glenn nailed it, you know, 15 years ago. And all these great minds, whether they chose to ignore the information or whether they thought they could continue to run a monopoly to maximize their margins, but it was arrogance. And so I think in the end, you're right, but I think it was arrogance that killed the music industry, or is killing it.
And it also has to do with the lie of the compact disc was, okay, we're putting out this new format, but the whole, you know, system of records and everything doesn't, we have to build a new sort of, a new infrastructure for this CD thing. And so at first it's going to cost more, okay? Yeah. But once it becomes the big format, the cost will come down and everyone, it'll equalize with LPs. It never did. It always stayed high artificially. They got to a point where they could manufacture CDs for a few cents and the price still never came down.
Yeah.
And that arrogance of just, well, they'll just buy it anyways.
They don't have a choice.
Yeah, they don't have a choice. If they want it, they're going to get it.
And then all of a sudden, we had a choice. And so, you know, I don't know about from the artist perspective, but from the label perspective, you know, these Pandoras and Spotify, and I like them. You know, it allows me to preview a lot of music. I still buy, my wife says too much music. I probably buy 6 to 10, maybe 12 titles a month, plus what you get at the radio station. But they were wrong, you know. I mean, they were totally wrong. And the people wanted it and the people got it. And you know, the byproduct of that is kind of what we're talking about, which is that golden era of the record store has suffered because of it. You know, there's kind of two things that are missing from that, I think. One is the knowledge that was behind the counter. And you would meet people, and I was running Homer's for 20 years, and you would meet people that had incredible depth of knowledge, really impressive. And they knew their niche, and they knew it, like, unbelievably well, which is always fun to talk to somebody that's an expert at what they know, and they really, really know it. And I think the other thing that you kind of miss is that exploration where you walk in, and you could, you know, you come in to buy this, but while you're in there, you find that you want also through the process of exploration. And I think that's missing. And I think the radio industry, because of what was called the impulse sale, kind of evaporated when people went to just-in-time inventories, or they tried to say, well, we don't have the T-Rex record, but we'll have it here on Wednesday. Well, you know what? I don't have the urge on Wednesday. Yeah, I have the urge now. And we made that mistake at Homer's, and we tried to manage our inventory to the numbers as everybody else did, because it became so competitive, you know? I mean, think about, you know, Hallmark stores for a period were selling CDs, and gas stations and grocery stores, and you know, we had a Circuit City, and we had every chain in the country here, and it was so competitive, and yet the allure of why we went to record stores was lost, I think, on everyone, which was that crazy-ass selection where I'm never going to buy this Bob Dylan record, but every time I walk in, I want to see it, you know, and that thing where these guys know what they're doing because they have Here, My Dear by Marvin Gaye. Because if you don't have that record, it's not really a record. I mean, I'm being facetious.
Yeah.
You know, it was that where you could go through, and it was kind of the trick when you shop the stores is you would look at the depth of the selection. And you know, when you got to the point where a record store in Des Moines was no different than a record store in Omaha, which was no different than a record store in Sacramento, the love affair was over. You know, it became milk. It became a homogenized product. And
At Best Buy, if you, even in the heyday of CDs, the late 90s, early 2000s, let's say, you go to Best Buy and you're looking up at the Kiss section. Well, maybe Kiss isn't a good example because stores have probably stocked most of their catalog. But they don't stock deep catalog. They stock the two newest records, and that's it.
Greatest hits package.
Greatest hits stuff. So in a way, the industry was starting to screw themselves right at that point too, because, well, this artist has 10 titles. You're only taking two, you know?
So there's no depth of sales. And you know, what was interesting, so a good... a good example of that is forever Led Zeppelin would not release compilation CDs of their material. You know, so you couldn't buy Led Zeppelin's greatest. You can now. But forever, they're like, you know, we don't need the money. We're not interested in that.
Yeah.
and they could, if you wanted that song, you had to buy that album and you got the other 8 tracks or 9 tracks that went with it. And so that whole mentality of the greatest hits package. And one of the things we haven't hit upon yet is as the industry goes through reformatting, so we go from the vinyl record to the DAT tape. I don't know if you remember DAT.
Yeah, I remember.
And there were some other kind of other recording devices there. And then you get the CD. And if you have a CD that came out in the original flight and you put it on now, you can barely hear it. And, you know, and so now
and they sound terrible, too. The first wave of CDs were just awful.
Yeah.
I don't know how people thought... thought it sounded so much better.
You just turned it up louder. Yeah. but now, you know, so the exact opposite occurred, which is you buy now a CD now, and it's just amped to the end, to the edge. And it's so loud, you know, it's like, I don't know about you, but to find a rock record where you can hear the nuance of the tone, the textures between the instruments, anymore on rock records, that's really hard. Now, Manorhead recommended a band on Facebook, something about the War on Drugs.
Yeah.
And I was listening, and they play texture really well. That's highly textured. And so, but you know, rock and roll band so many times, and even on my show, some of the records I get, it's just, let's make everything louder than everything else. And you just can't hear it. You can't, you know. What's impressive is, like, my nephew, who's probably in his late 20s now, he's aware of the music of his era, and he has his favorite artist, but, you know, what do you want to play? He's picking stuff from the 60s and 70s again. And to, one of the aspects that made that era different is that, so if you look at very few bands in that era that I can think of off the top of my head made it on their first record, but there was artist development. And I think what you see now is kind of, I don't know about your show, but on the show, the radio show that I do, you can, like, you get one record from a band and then you never hear from them again.
Yeah.
And there's no, very little development. So if you think about the great bands that altered the course of rock music, I would argue vehemently that those came up through the record stores, whether that's REM or U2 or bands like Rush. They got embraced at some level by record store geeks, and they were touted, and by about the fifth album, they cross over, and The Clash is a great example of that. And so what is missing is that component where there's artist development coupled with a knowledgeable base of people that are out there advocating on behalf of the band. And at the same time, I have to say this is the thing that sickened me about the music industry, is you would, you know, you'd hang around with geeks and I always remember, I was at lunch one time and a guy was talking about Gillian Welch.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, who, what? And then, you know, I finally connected, like, Gillian Welch, and I'm watching this guy, and he's a very knowledgeable guy, you know, a guy with great knowledge. And I'm sure he's looking at me like, who is this guy, this jackass that doesn't know who this is, you know? And the thing about the industry that I despise and still despise is this idea that we must all lock elbows and march to the beat of this band. And then 90 days later or 2 weeks later, we all have to shift gears and now begin to support that band. And within that, then I would argue that within that music store culture, there's people that get music. There's people that, in my opinion, intuitively understand it and love it for what it is. And there's people that are smart and they've memorized all the artists and they kind of know who's hip and who's not. But they're, in my opinion, too readily able to shift gears from the flavor of the day as it continually evolves. And to me, you know, you just look at it and you're like, well, what, you know, 6 months ago you liked this band, now you don't even acknowledge it.
Yeah.
You know, you don't say anything about them. And so I wonder, what's the emotional connection? And I guess I hated that about the music industry, which I perceive, and maybe I'm wrong, but I always perceived it as a disingenuine.
Well, it has a lot to do with, you know, the corporatization of the industry and having, like you say, MBAs come in and start taking over labels. There's always people who love music, were always involved in labels, but the bean counters really took over in a lot of ways, and I agree 100% with that artist development thing.
Yeah.
If Bruce Springsteen came out today, he would not even be a one-hit wonder. He would be dropped after one album because his second-week sales weren't high enough, and so the label would just give up, and then they would eventually, 6 months down the line, drop the artist, you know, buy him out or whatever, and mm-hmm. you're gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you don't get to make four albums before you have your big record. Because the expectations are too extreme now.
Yeah.
You know, that you have to hit such a target at this point, otherwise you're gone.
Yeah.
And, you know, in a way I feel vindicated because I've been saying this for 20 some odd years that, like, this is the way the industry treats people and, you know, it's just not right and this and that. And nobody really cared. And, of course, now that it's gone and people are like, well, it's because they didn't really develop artists. It's like, yeah, I was saying that 20 years ago.
Well, you know? Yeah. Shifting gears a little bit, kind of another thing is this argument that you hear from the independent guys now, which is kind of a we're cool and we deserve your support. Why? You know, that's another thing that always... So, was it your Facebook page I saw that on this week?
I don't remember.
I was reading it where, you know, some guy had written an article, some record store guy had written an article, and basically, you know, we're the purveyors of cool, and we deserve your support. And you know, someone had the audacity to post, well, why? You know, what is it I owe you, you know? Exactly. Articulate that argument. And you know, you can't, it's an emotional argument, which is really, we represent a dying breed and we're dying quicker than than I want us to die. And I understand the argument, but there's no, you know, I didn't ever feel like, I got tired of making the argument and I felt there was never it was never required that people reciprocate, you know, to that, that they.
When did you start noticing the decline in terms of the industry at large, and also just Homers as a chain?
Yeah, well, I mean, with Homers, you know, it was kind of masqueraded, I think, for us in that there were some kind of intercompany politics going on where we had I'm trying to figure out how to say this and not get sued, but, you know, I don't think that we were given an honest paradigm from which to judge the success of our organization. Is that vague enough?
Yeah, that's pretty
okay.
Vague.
and so it was hard to make decisions. And simultaneously then we had, like I say, stores within a block of each other. So we go through this process of, you know, buying these two chains and opening a store in Council Bluffs, and we're growing like crazy, and it's just like stretching us to the max. And as soon as we get to the max, then we begin this immediate process of shrinking. And simultaneously, you know, we would just get numbers that made no sense, just couldn't figure out, like, these numbers make no sense. And so, you know, you kind of go into that mode where, you know, honestly, it was kind of a panic, like, you know, what's the stability here? What's it look like? How do we make quality decisions? And you know, Mike Fratt, were kind of in the situation of running the organization. And it was always a lot of like, what do we do? What do we do? How do we analyze this? How do we understand what this means? And dynamically, then, so we're having what I think is like I say, we're having a hard time getting numbers that we can make good decisions from. Simultaneously, you know, the chain expands and it contracts, and that is so emotional for the people that are involved with that, that you're dealing with all of that. And then the industry goes through this kind of you know, transition of format, and it's just, you know, we've been through SACD and CD and remix remastered CD and you know, 180 gram vinyl and blah, blah. So, you know, there's a format change every year, practically. UCDs, the CD wars, the UCDs wars, all that stuff. And so when the MP3 came along, you know, to some degree, you're looking at it and you're like, this is a format change. What does this mean? Well, we've survived all the other ones. We just need to figure out how to make it work. And so you're watching the industry kind of react to this, and they're trying to sort it out. And you know, so honestly, the warning flags didn't go off immediately. You know, I maybe I'm stupid.
Do you think it was denial of just it? There's no way that people could stop buying physical product of music.
Yeah.
There's just no way this could happen.
It was a crazy time, you know, and it was a difficult time. There was
what kind of time frame are you looking at from going from, say, 17, 18 stores down to where Homer's is now one? I mean, that's a pretty drastic reduction.
It is.
And that's been semi-recent the last couple of years. I mean, I don't know when you left, but you might have already been gone by the time they got down to, like, you know, the very slow single digits, 3, 2, 1.
Well, I think I left in 2005, okay. And it was a weird period, you know, because, you know, I was changing everything about my life. You know, I had three kids and going back to school, and I'd run for the public office while I was trying to run it, the company, and so it was a pretty weird time. But you know, I kind of, after I left, I really lost touch, you know, with it, because it was, the music industry is a wicked wife, and you miss her terribly, you know, and the only way to get over that heartache, if you will, is mm-hmm. to just never call. You know, you cannot go back to that.
Well, let's talk about your radio show.
Okay.
Pacific Street Blues.
And Americana.
Now, when did you actually start doing it, and what was the impetus? What was the idea behind starting the show?
Well, it was kind of a spur of the moment, really, like most things in my life. And I was there's a new radio station in town called The View, which I think was KKVU. And Diney Landon had bought a new signal, 105.9, from the FCC, just became available. And so Tom Sleeker was programming it. And I walked in to talk to Tom one time. So Homer's was a big advertiser on that station. And I'm talking to Tom, and I notice he has all these national shows, samples of these national blues shows on his desk. And I'm like, you know, I'll do a blues show for you. Would you really? Yeah, I would. I'd love that. You know, I'd done radio at KUWR in Wyoming, and then KVNO here in Omaha, and WSPO, the student programming on UNO's campus. And so he's like, okay, so that was June of 91.
Okay.
And it's weird, as I always thought it was 89, you know. And so I remember the first song was All in the Groove by Blues Traveler.
Okay.
And so I'm looking at it one day, and I'm like, 1991, there's no way. My show started in 89. And I went back and looked at, it was 91.
So you started in 91, so that's that's 25
years.
25 years.
Yeah.
Okay.
Long time.
Now, after all this time of doing the show, why do you still do it? I mean, do you still enjoy doing it after 25 years? Is it still something that you are, can you still get excited about doing it? A two-hour program after doing it so many... Three-hour program after doing it all this time.
Well, there was a period where I was really burned out on it, and I tried to hand it off to Terry O'Halloran, and then I tried to hand it off to another guy in the blues community, because I was just burned out on it, you know? And I kind of decided... So I'm answering your question in the longest way possible. I kind of decided, you know, when they start paying me, I'll start trying to do it the way it should be done. But in the meantime, I'm just going to play the records I want to play. And so what I try to do, I really, and I'm sure you've been doing yours how long?
December will be 10 years.
10 years. So when you walk out, you know whether it was a great show or not.
Yeah, I definitely can notice a difference.
Yeah.
And it's not based on response from the audience, because my feeling is, only people who are negative and haters are the kind who call into stations, because you call a radio station for two reasons, three reasons, to win a contest, to make a request, or to complain.
Yeah.
Nobody calls to say, I love this. This is great.
Yeah.
You know? So my feeling, it's just solely based on what I think, you know, was I feeling together during this show? I mean, there are times during the third hour I can barely even remember doing the first hour.
Yeah.
And on those I feel like this must not be a really good show, because I feel barely present doing
it. Yeah, yeah.
And then other times it's like, wow, that went by so fast. That was so great. I really, you know.
And you know, a great show is kind of like hitting that perfect shot when you play golf. And I'm a terrible golfer, but, you know, if you go out for 18 holes, you're going to get three or four shots that are like, y'all come back now shots is what I call them. And doing a radio show is kind of the same way, where, you know, if you weaved it together the right way, whether it connected or not. And kind of my attitude is it's my show, and if you don't like it, get your own show.
Yeah.
But you know, that sounds really arrogant or negative, but, and I don't mean it to, but what I mean is that it is a, for me, act of love is two, you know, nonsensical words, but it's something that really comes where you want to, this artist deserves to be heard. I need to promote this artist But I have these obligations to these labels that have supported me for 25 years. So I'm going to play their records. And I know that listeners want to hear these kind of artists. So I, even though I'm not in love with them, I need to work them in. So how do I weave that all together where it's a entertaining show? And what I try to do, and I think what you try to do, is give a heavy amount of attention to local artists. Because really, that's what differentiates, you know, a show.
It's local, and it's artists that are coming to the local area.
Absolutely.
Which is what I think distinguishes a show like yours and mine from satellite radio or syndicated shows.
Yeah.
If a band like The War on Drugs, you mentioned, okay, if they're playing at the Waiting Room next week, I can play them on my show the week before and say, hey, they're coming up on Sunday, or they're coming up this Thursday. Whereas a satellite radio show, you're not going to have that emphasis on something that you could actually go see next week or in 2 weeks or something like that. That's, I think, the advantage.
Yeah.
What it is. I don't play too much local music per se. Some.
Yeah.
But that aspect, I think, is a big deal.
See, I'm trying to get up to 2 tracks an hour. And I just, like, you know, I mean, it's public radio. Or in my instance, you know, in our instance, it's really not public. It's non-com.
Yeah.
And so we're non-commercial radio, and for God's sake, if a non-com can't play a local release, then what's the point, you know? And so when you look at the great music communities like San Francisco with KFOG, and they put out that release every Christmas of local artists, or you look at, Austin, Texas, you know, these are markets. What's their station down there in Fredericksburg, Texas Pirate Radio? They pump 100,000 watts into their local artist scene, and it's paid off for them, you know. And so I don't have that luxury to do that 24/7, but you know, I think it's a moral calling.
and how for people who hear the show who are not local, mm-hmm. Tell them how they could actually listen to the show.
Yeah, so the show is from 9 to noon Central Standard Time, and it can be heard online at 897theriver.com. And then what I do is record it and put it onto a podcast, which is kiwrblues.podomatic.com. And, you know, the one thing I would say is this is not the traditional blues show. What I'm trying to do is weave in Jack White's solo records in with how does it fit next to John Lee Hooker or Muddy Waters, and then you know, you got to weave in your contemporary blues acts, but then I try to have a strong Omaha music presence, and I don't have the connections that a lot of people have, and then I try to also weave in some of those great classic rock tracks that make sense. So you know, there used to be a radio station here in Omaha called The City, 106.9 The City.
Yeah, I remember.
And we would always kind of jokingly say 7 in a row that you don't know. And you know, when you're working in the music industry for 25 years and someone plays 7 songs in a row and you've never heard of any of the artists, they're way out on the edge.
Yeah,
you know?
That's unusual.
So you know, I use the classic rock to try to bring people back in. So whether it's, you know, mid-period Stones or Zeppelin or, you know, a lot of Eric Clapton, it kind of gives you that anchor where you know kind of where I'm heading. And yet then I always feel like if I play a song or an artist that someone's familiar with, then they're willing to give me 2 songs to kind of take them to a new direction as long as they know I'm going to bring them back. And recently I've explored, and I'm having a lot of fun with the idea of these tribute albums. So, you know, do we really need to hear, you know, a Lynyrd Skynyrd, Give Me 3 Steps one more time? No. But it might be interesting if it was covered by, you know, Warren Haynes' band. So I'm using these tribute records where artists cover songs by other artists. So there's the Allman Brothers, you know, everybody now. So it's not the Rolling Stones doing it, but it's Luther Allison doing it. And so I try to use that as well. So I would say, I know I'm not an indie rock guy, but I think people that are genuinely into music would enjoy it. I had one where I had a chance to go down to Lincoln and interview Dr. John. And so are you...
Yeah.
And so, again, it was one of those where, you know, it's a guy, I bet I've got 50 Dr. John albums at home. And so I knew his career pretty well, and I'm going through the interview with him, and, you know, I really, really admire the guy, and it was not going well. And you know, you realize this stinks, and he's just going through the routines, and you're going through. So I kind of like, how did you get Red Tyler back on the road again? He's like, motherfucker, how do you know about Red Tyler? You know, I'm like, I know your stuff, you know. And after that, you could tell the entire
switch turned. Yep, now yep. He's interested.
Okay, this is a guy that knows what he's talking about, and so by the end of the interview, he's got his arm around me, and it was a good. It was one of those super rewarding experiences.
Now I imagine for all the years that you work in a record retail and also doing the radio show, you probably met plenty of rock stars over the years.
Yeah.
What's your personal favorite sort of meet and greet or just meeting a rock star story that you have?
Well, the most memorable one is meeting the Stones, you know.
Oh, wow.
So I've met them 4 times now. So that's the most memorable one. But you know, they're so guarded,
yeah,
and understandably, that it's not really, you know, it's not much of a human interaction. Guy, strangely enough, one of the guys that stands out the most is John Bon Jovi. And so I am not a fan of his music at all, but he did an in-store for Homer's in the mid-80s, and I was not there. But
I was there. As a teenager, I actually have a funny story about that when you finish, I'll tell you.
But he was so kind, and his reputation, and I'd worked in the early 80s when he was up and coming. He opened for 38 Special, mm-hmm. and I was doing backstage security for Mark Miller and Tommy Bergen, and working with John. And at one point, we had to clear the back area where John's band had performed, and we had to move them so 38 Special could come out. And he was super nice then. And then a couple other times, then we had a chance to meet him. And again, I'm not a fan of the music, but he is really consistently one of the most remarkably nice guys. And not nice as in polite, but nice as in, tell me about you.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that's pretty cool. And yeah, so Mike and I were down in Florida for some convention. And it was one of those things where we're in the adult theme park for Disney. It's like Treasure Island or something.
Okay.
And so we're walking to get to the Capitol Records World Party, and Lenny Kravitz and those guys were playing. And John's kind of walking along, and he and Mike start to talk, and Mike kind of reminds him of the in-store, and he's like, oh God, Homer's, and he's going on and on about what a great time he had. And so we're standing there, and we're watching the band, and at one point he looks at us like, you guys want a beer and a hot dog or anything? I'm like, sure, I take a beer and a hot dog. So he goes over and gets us a beer and a hot dog, you know? And you know, again, he didn't have to do that. So he's one of those guys where I wish his music was more to my liking.
I wish I liked it more.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, because he is a good guy. My favorite band of all time is Kiss, and that's just a fact. And I'm not in any way embarrassed about it, but I just like to qualify it by saying that, yeah, I think Gene Simmons is a douchebag too.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean I can't be a fan of what they did in the 70s. I don't have to like him now.
Yeah.
As a person.
Yeah.
Because he seems like a ridiculous douchebag. But when I was a kid and I met Kiss a number of times at 14, 15 years old, I have to say they went out of their way to be nice to fans.
Yeah.
Gene Simmons was always nice. He even remembered me 3 months later. I'd met him in Omaha, and then I met him again in Des Moines about 2-3 months later, and he actually remembered me from that other time.
Cool.
And it wasn't, I could tell it was real, because he made a reference to something that actually happened.
Right.
And I was just blown away by that. I mean, that he could actually remember. So, you know, sometimes there's that public persona versus the who they really are or whatever, you know. And I actually think that Gene Simmons, if you got him alone in a room, would not be such a douchebag. I think he feels like he has to turn it on when there's cameras. All right. Well, thanks for doing the interview, Rick.
My pleasure.
All right. And that'll wrap up podcast number 118. Thanks again to Rick for doing the interview. Hope you enjoyed that one. As always, you can check out his blues show at kiwrblues.podomatic.com or listen to it live when it streams Sunday morning. And then, of course, if you do that, you better be staying tuned for when I come on at 2:00, just a couple hours after Rick's show ends. Again, thanks everyone for listening. This has been the Dark Stuff Podcast.
Transfer of data is complete.